This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument this morning is case number 30480, Dwayne Remington et al. Versus Wild Bill's Campground et al. Michael Beardsley is present, will be arguing on behalf of the appellants Remington. And Jeffrey Hurd is present and will be arguing on behalf of Brian Iverson. So with that, Mr. Beardsley, you can proceed with your initial 15-minute argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, counsel, and may it please the court, my name is Mike Beardsley. I represent the appellants Dwayne and Melly D. Remington in this matter. There are two issues before this court today. The first is whether the lower court erred in holding that a property disclosure statement pursuant to SDCL 43338 was not required where the sale in this case included a residence and dwelling unit.
But you get to that somewhat indirectly, right? Or do you? And my question, I guess, is, without speaking in riddles, I'm sorry, but my question is, that is an obligation, if it is one, of the seller, not the real estate agent. Is that right?
Your Honor, I believe the case law in this case requires the real estate agent as a professional to advise his clients, which included the seller and the buyer in this case, that one would be required if there is a dwelling unit and a residence is involved in the transaction.
So that would be the indirect route. In other words, Mr. Iverson wasn't himself obligated to complete a disclosure statement.
That's correct.
Okay.
And where does his obligation to disclose it come from, or to tell them that they have to do it come from?
It comes from our South Dakota statutes, Your Honor, and the Says case requiring a professional real estate agent to be knowledgeable of the transactions and advise his clients through the fiduciary duty that he's obligated to of the nature of the transaction. And one of the most important parts of a real estate transaction is our disclosure requirements. It's set forth in the statute. There's a number of pages in a form for the seller to fill out. Now, it is not the obligation of the realtor to discover material defects, but if the realtor is aware of any material defects that could affect the use and enjoyment of the property on behalf of the buyer, there is a clear obligation for that realtor to disclose this information.
So now you're talking about direct disclosure, right? So this is the portion of your case where you're saying, look, if he knew about disclosures, he had to actually disclose them, switching from he's got to advise us of the disclosure statement obligation.
I think it includes both, Your Honor. The first matter is through Mr. Iverson's knowledge of the property, through the fact that he had listed it for the last 10 years prior to this transaction, showed it over 30 times, testified in his deposition that he knew people had lived there. In fact, both previous owners of this property had lived in the living residence. At that moment, before an offer is made by the buyer, it is our position that Mr. Iverson was required to tell the seller and the buyer that a property disclosure statement was required. He never did that. He titled this as a commercial transaction, told the seller, you don't need to fill anything out. Subsequent to the purchase, my clients discovered numerous defects with the property that would have been discovered had this property disclosure statement been filled out.
So are you arguing that he actually had actual? I understand that argument. That I get. Are you, in addition to that, arguing that he had actual knowledge of some defects associated with the property that you allege exist, that he needed to disclose himself? Look, I've been on this property a number of times. I'm aware of X, and you need to know about this. Is that part of your case?
That is part of our case, Your Honor.
Well, upon what evidence do you rely for that type of knowledge?
Your Honor, there are numerous facts that support, and that's the second issue that I was getting to. I believe that at the summary judgment stage, the lower court applied the wrong standard. All inferences should be viewed in light most favorable to the non-moving party, my clients. Now, we took numerous depositions in this case. There was mold that was discovered in the basement. The mold had been covered up by paneling. The seller had admitted that the mold was covered up and never disclosed. The listing, most specifically, was created by Mr. Iverson. Mr. Iverson had testified that throughout the years when improvements or changes were made to the property, it was his obligation to modify and update the listing, which he testified that he did. The property also listed that there were two new bridges built on the property when, in fact, the bridges were built 7 and 9 years prior to.
So back to my question. So, and I understand if your answer is those should be imputed to Iverson by some sort of constructive knowledge or his familiarity, I get it. Is that what you're driving at there?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. I believe a reasonable jury could conclude that Iverson was aware of these material defects with the property and these issues with the listing and should have disclosed those to my client.
So do you have anything beyond that in the record that says that, for example, the mold, that Iverson knew about the mold?
We don't have direct testimony from Mr. Iverson that says, yes, I admit it, counsel, that I did know about the mold and I didn't tell your clients, or I did know that the bridges were defective and I didn't tell them. No, we do not have that. But what we do have is a set of facts indicating that this gentleman was not your standard real estate agent, that seller puts the property on the market and a few weeks or a few months go by and it's sold. This gentleman had a relationship with the seller. He'd been friends with him for 30 years. He'd showed the property over 30 separate times. Every single showing, he showed up at the property. These facts should be considered by a jury, and a jury should determine whether or not he had knowledge of material defects that he had to disclose.
So is the jury determination, in your view, still a constructive knowledge requirement or an actual knowledge, subjective knowledge?
I think that the jury could find that there is actual knowledge of these material defects.
Well, not whether they could, but what must they find before there's liability?
Well, I think the jury can assess the credibility of the witnesses and either believe Mr. Iverson's testimony or not believe him and find that he did have actual knowledge of these conditions, and he'd been trying to move the property for 10 years and finally had an opportunity to do so and told his client, the seller, you don't need to disclose anything. Now,
go back to that. I'm sorry, Mr. Beardsley, I took you away from the disclosure. So you may be transitioning, and I apologize for that. Please get back into that. I know you want to talk about that, and I want to hear it too.
And I have a question about the disclosure.
Sure.
So this is a residential these are residential disclosure statutes. This is arguably a mixed-use property. How are we to analyze the applicability of the residential disclosure statute to a mixed-use property such as this?
Well, I think the court should look at the Miller v. Harrington case out of Nebraska. That case involved the sale of a tavern. The primary purpose of the transaction was for commercial use. However, the building had an apartment on the second floor. The statutes in Nebraska are nearly identical, defining residential property, which our statutes define residential property as having not more than 4 dwelling units on the property. Clearly, the testimony and the evidence in this case indicates there was a dwelling unit on this property. The Nebraska Supreme Court said the statute is clear, the definition of residential property is clear, and if you have a dwelling unit, you must have a disclosure statement. And I think that this court should adopt that very reasoning,
So let me stop you there. And I understand, I've read the Nebraska case law, I've read our statute, and Justice Kern asked you about how should we read this statute. Maybe the better question is, how should Mr. Iverson have understood that statute in the context of this transaction? In other words, did he have we've got an unsettled question of law, I think, in South Dakota. So did he have a duty in that instance to say, you know what, I'm not sure if the statute applies or not, but you might want to ask for one. And is that maybe something that an expert needs to come in and say, you know what, there is a duty in this case to, versus, the Saez case says as a matter of law, you got to disclose if it's a residential. Here you got this open question. Does it maybe is it not quite framed the same way as the Saez case because of that? And we do have an open question under our law whether or not what kind of a transaction this is.
Well, I think that's a good question, Your Honor. And the answer to your question is yes. If there is a question, a realtor has a duty to advise his clients that a seller disclosure statement is required. I don't think there's any question. Mr. Iverson testified that he knew there were living quarters. In fact, people lived in them. That's a dwelling unit. The statute is clear. Now, a majority of the transactions, real estate transactions that we deal with in this state, I believe are residential in nature. It's not like this concept is foreign to the professionals that sell property. So in answering your question, if there is a mixed question, absolutely. Why not? Err on the side of caution. In addition, there's public policy concerns and reasons why we have this statute and why this court has been so serious in enforcing
it. But error on the side of question is different than a legal duty. Did he have a legal duty to advise on a question that maybe is still an open question?
Absolutely. And, Your Honor, the nature, the procedural nature of this case, we didn't get far enough, but there will be expert testimony from other realtors that will testify that, yes, in a mixed transaction or the sale of a campground, when there's a residence, you require the seller to provide a disclosure statement.
Disclosure of what? What's the scope of the disclosure in a mixed?
I think the scope of the disclosure is exactly how it's laid out in our statute, which...
Would they have been required to disclose the bridge, which has nothing to do with the residential?
I believe that they would, Your Honor. And I think according to the Miller case in Nebraska, because there's a dwelling unit, fill out the disclosure statement.
During the February 19 hearing, Mr. Arlinson suggested to the court that, look, I mean, even if there's a duty, it really only relates to the water penetration and mold issues because that's all that was really affected by the residents. And so I'm guessing from your answer to Justice Myron's question that you would disagree with that. You think that if there is a duty to disclose under the 43-4 statutory disclosure, it applies to everything. If that's the case, aren't we far afield from family dwelling unit when we start to talk about campfire rings, bridges? All these are for a commercial enterprise. How would we connect that with the statutory duty to disclose for a residential property?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor, but the legislature was clear. It did not carve out an exception for primary purpose.
But it only applies to instances where you have residential real estate or real property, and that's four or fewer family dwelling units all under one roof. And so is the family dwelling unit here, if that is a family dwelling unit, how is that related in any way to bridges or fire pits or financial performance for a business or anything like that? How is that even in the same, realm?
Sure. In the disclosure statute, which sets forth the form 43-444, goes beyond just the dwelling house. The disclosure statute talks about lot lines. It talks about violations of ordinance. It talks about prior history with the entire property, including the driveway, the yard. So I get your point, Justice, but you're already, when you disclose a residential property, going outside the walls of the dwelling unit. So I don't think there would be any more onerous obligation on a seller just to list any knowledgeable defects with the property pursuant to what's required by our statute.
So that would seem to require you're selling a 1,000-acre farm with one dwelling house in the very middle of the farm, that they would be required to disclose any problem on that entire 1,000-acre farm. Your argument?
I think that would be the best policy. Now, of course, there could be a carve-out exception where you have to disclose just the residential portion of a mixed transaction, but the fact of the matter is, Justice, here, there was no disclosure. It should have been advised that there was a disclosure.
So let's talk about that for a second. So your theory is that Mr. Iverson had a fiduciary obligation to tell them that they were entitled to a disclosure. Suppose he had fulfilled the obligation that you thought by telling them you have an obligation to disclose anything wrong with the residents. And they had done that, but they hadn't disclosed anything about the bridge. They hadn't disclosed anything about any of the other things outside the residence. What's your theory for his liability there?
Well,
where does he have a fiduciary responsibility to tell them that you have to give a disclosure statement for things outside the residence? Well, since it seems like an open question here.
Okay, so even if the residence defects were disclosed, the mold in the basement, the deck encroaching in the right of way, things of that nature, and the other defects were not disclosed, I don't think that matters, because if the realtor knows of these material defects, he has an obligation to advise his clients of such. So in that regard, Your Honor, I believe he had an obligation, once he knew there was a dwelling unit, to say, seller, fill out this disclosure statement. That was never done, and as a result, my clients walked into a transaction blind and were hit with a number of expensive defects, which resulted in this lawsuit, and I believe a disclosure statement would have prevented that. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Beardsley. Mr. Hurd, you can proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court, Mr. Beardsley. My name is Jeff Hurd, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Brian Iverson, today. The Court has two big questions to answer and one smaller question to answer. The first question, what does residential mean in the operative phrase of the statute, residential real property? 43.4.37.3 purports to define it, but it doesn't. It's circular. It says residential real property means residential real property that has fewer than four dwelling units. Well, that's circular. The operative limitation, residential real property, which is all that tells you when 43.438 applies, they don't define what that means. Really, 43.4.37.3 is really more of an exception. All it says is it doesn't apply if you have more than four dwelling units. Residential must mean something. Why? Statutory construction. We know we just don't define the word out of existence. Number two, it answers the questions that have been bothering this court through appellant's argument. Number one, it's limited only to residences, period. How do we know that? Well, if we accept the appellant's argument that residential real property means all real property with fewer than four dwelling units, you're standing in a residential real property. This building has fewer than four residences. Zero is about as few as you can get. And that's why Miller doesn't apply, and that's what makes Nebraska different. So, little foreshadowing, the Nebraska legislature abrogated Miller right after it was decided. At the time Miller was decided, their statute said this: residential real property is real property that has one to four dwelling units on it. Ours says residential real property is residential real property that has fewer than four dwelling units on it. So the word residential is the operative adjective in the statutory definition that applies to when these notices, which are used every day, are legally required. Unfortunately, no one has defined it yet. That's probably the biggest thing this court can do today, is to define what does residential mean in residential real property.
So it almost seems like the way the arguments are shaping up is there's an argument that it would apply to this transaction not at all, which is kind of what happened. It would apply completely to everything. Or maybe it would apply to the part of the property that does seem to have some of the features of a family dwelling unit. So if that's the case, maybe it's not an all or nothing proposition. What about this idea that it might apply more narrowly which may have its own host of application, you know, problems. But what about that concept?
I don't think it can work under the current statutory definition applied at 43.437.3. Nebraska's might. Why? Because Nebraska says it's today, Nebraska says it's real property with 1 to 4 residences primarily used for residential purposes. Again, I'm going to foreshadow, I'm going to suggest you should adopt that standard. Primarily used for residential purposes. But the Nebraska statute says it has to have at least one. South Dakota's statute says residential real property means residential real property with less than 4 residences under a single structure.
Describe for me a residential real property that doesn't have any residents on it. Is that a lot in the city? Is that your idea?
Well, I'm again going to suggest you use Nebraska's definition, that it is primarily used for residential purposes. I looked at other standards getting ready for this argument. We could use zoning. What if it's zoned residential? The problem is this is a statewide statute. Zoning is done locally. You could wind up with a statute that applies differently in Sioux Falls than it does in Rapid City.
You know, some of our cases recognize, and I'm in agreement with you. I think we have to read the statute, and I'm not suggesting you decide the case based upon whatever purposes or policies or something like that. That's not our job. But we have commented sort of by the by in some of our cases that, hey, this is really designed to protect buyers who are unaware of these. And so it's to prompt sellers to disclose these things that they know about. What would justify, in an instance like this, what would justify exempting someone who is buying a residence in conjunction with an adjoining criminal enterprise from the same protections that somebody who's buying a residence that doesn't have that?
The primary purpose. Here you had a commercial real estate transaction that conveyed trademarks. Residences don't have that. Commercial property, and Justice Alter, I understand your question.
But
why don't we require these disclosures for all real property?
But that wouldn't be very satisfying to the people who say, we're going to move into this new business, and we didn't know about the problems, but if there wouldn't have been the new business, we would have known about the new problems.
So then you're going to start split. I don't know that, particularly in this case, that helps us. The bedroom was used as an office and storage. The kitchen was used as storage for the restaurant and bar.
Let's talk more generically.
Okay. You know. So if you applied it more generically, I think if the primary purpose of the transaction is commercial, then it is not residential real property. Residential real property has to mean something, and that's the mega standard.
So that goes to the 1,000-acre farm then. Under your theory, though, if someone buys a 1,000-acre farm that has a house in it, you are not required to do a disclosure statement on the house?
That I would say that is not residential real property. That's true. If it's being bought as agricultural
And you land. Think that's consistent with the legislative intent under the statutes, that there's clearly the purchase of a house involved in the property. Everyone knows that this is a residence, and under that, they don't have to disclose anything about the residence.
Justice Myron, I'm going to have to confess that I did not run the counterfactuals that far as I was preparing for my argument today. I can see a distinction, particularly if you have a separately platted residence. Okay. The question, of course, then, having not gone back and done any of the research on that particular thing, I can also see if it's a family farm, there's a sense in which in South Dakota, family farms, the whole thing kind of has a residential feel to it, whereas if it were purchased by ConAgra or leased without the house being used, or the house is occasionally used by a hired man. I could think of other examples of that. I did not run that counterfactual coming in. I mean, I can give you my opinion off the top of my head is that's something the legislature would have to address if they wanted to.
Let me shift you to Iverson's obligations here. So what's your theory of his relationship he clearly has some obligations to both the buyer and the seller as their agents, correct?
Yeah, yes.
And he has a fiduciary obligation?
No.
Although
no.
Not even a limited fiduciary obligation?
None. No.
Explain.
Says was just look at footnote 4 of Says. Even Says says The rule would not be different if 30, or the rule would be different if 3621A140 had been adopted at the time of this transaction. It's legislative now. Statutorily, the legislature has said here is the duty of limited agents. There's no question this is a limited agent, right? In the record, page 160, page 162, the plaintiff's responses to the statement of undisputed facts, no question this is a limited agency. So whereas there's only one place you can look to find the duties, and that is 3621A140, no fiduciary duties. And I'll also say this, just by comparison. 3621A32 and 3621A36, which are both statutes for single agents, where you owe only your duty to one side of the transaction, expressly the legislature has said no fiduciary duty is owed. None.
Does it really matter? Because the fiduciary duty incorporated common law concepts of standard of care and reasonable care and skill, and that's part of the 140 statute anyway.
140 has a duty of care, but in this the facts of this particular case, buyers, the appellants, came to Mr. Iverson and said, we've already negotiated the deal. Here are the terms. You're to draw the contract, and we want to close as soon as we can. Under those circumstances, his duty of care is to carry out their instructions to paper the deal and get it closed as soon as they can. Now, to their benefit, he also included inspection rights that they could make closing contingent on an inspection, and they never asked for one. They never had an inspection done. So I don't think there's a duty of care issue given how this came in. The issue there is sub 4. Duty of care under 140 is sub 2. Sub 4 is the duty of to disclose adverse material facts of which he has actual knowledge. And Justice Devaney, that is the test. The standard is actual knowledge. So look at Tipton versus Town of Tabor. In that, different facts, right? That was a case in which it's a dog bite case, right? Public duty doctrine was the issue. But the court very clearly said where actual knowledge is the standard, should have known doesn't survive summary judgment.
So he's arguing that there's the court should look at the circumstantial evidence. He's shown this property 30 times.
Right.
And he's listed it for 10 years, et cetera.
Right. So Mr. Beardsley made the comment that you're to take all inferences, you're to infer everything that can be done. That's not true. The standard is you make reasonable inferences. What's a reasonable inference? It must follow from the evidence you actually have, and it cannot rest on speculation or conjecture. In this case, the only way you get to actual knowledge is speculation and conjecture. So let's say he showed the property once, 5, 10, 100 times. The mold that they complain of had been paneled over. Would not see that. Fire rings, the deck location, you need a survey for those. Those are right-of-way encroachments, regulatory issues. There's no evidence that he understood that any of those defects were in play. He had no reason to know that when he was told that the bridges had been redone, that they had not been redone. He swore that he had no knowledge of any of these.
So do you think that, you're getting back to your reasonable care argument, so do you think someone can come in and say, hey, look, we're effectively disclaiming that we really need your professional help because we've got it all figured out. And that somehow, and I'm paraphrasing, and I don't mean to be silly about it, but that sort of absolves him in some ways, maybe under your argument of this standard of care. What would exist to justify them having any professional relationship at all then between as being a real estate agent and a client? I mean, they're just two separate people and he's just doing things, not really for them.
Sure.
They've got it all worked out.
If he had known about a material adverse condition, he would have had to disclose that.
I mean, how about under the sub two, under the reasonable care?
Well, the reasonable duty is a question of law, both its existence and scope are determined as a matter of law.
Breach oftentimes is a question of fact.
Breach is often a question of fact, but when the
question of fact, sometimes it's disputed, but yes.
Sure. Sometimes there's not enough sufficient evidence to get it to the jury, but it's typically a fact question. When you come and you define the scope of the task you want a professional to perform, that scope is what defines what care when one has used insufficient care.
So let me explore that from a different direction. Now, Mr. Iverson's sitting in his office. Buyer comes in, says, that we're here. Now, take out any issues about it being a residential property. It's absolutely, unquestionably a residential property. And they say, hey, we're going to buy this house from this guy. We made our deal. We want you to write up the contract. Your theory is, at that point, he has no obligation to say to them, oh, by the way, there needs to be a disclosure statement.
In a limited agency. Because the standard is set in 43.448, is that the seller has the obligation. Says, which was decided before the decisions came down, or before the legislature made the changes, imposed a duty on buyer's sole agents to advise the buyer that they should be receiving a seller's disclosure statement. But as a legislative matter, those laws were changed. SAYS is not good law anymore. Take 2 seconds just to talk about Jarquot, which came up after that. Hard to square. The only thing I can say is it looked like none of the lawyers cited to the statute, because the statute that sets the standard isn't even referenced in the decision.
That's one question. So, briefly, there was a notice of review that was filed. We allowed for that. It didn't seem like we got argument on that, and I'm seeing that correctly.
Mr. Erlinson tells me the client has decided to abandon that.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank you. Mr. Beardsley, you may proceed.
Thank you.
Counsel, given the limited time here, I want to just get this question in, because this is where I wanted to go and we ran out of time initially. The definition of residential real property, this also struck me as very significant. It doesn't say what you've been arguing, that all real property consisting of not more than family dwelling units for. It says all residential property. So that's a term, and it is sort of circular, but it doesn't just say all real property. It has that term. What is your response to why that doesn't mean this has to be residential property before you apply the rest of the definition there?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, because it says dwelling unit, and to dwell is to reside either permanently or temporarily. Dwelling house is defined as a structure or place to dwell. The second reason, Your Honor, is that in this case, we have undisputed evidence that people lived there. I mean, this isn't where a barkeep spends the night in the basement on a cot. It was advertised with photographs that you have laundry facilities, you have a kitchen, you have half bath. I think it was 2 bedrooms in the basement. So it was advertised as a residence.
Well, wasn't it? It was advertised as commercial property, wasn't it?
But the list...
It had to include a commercial property that included a dwelling unit.
Sure. It was.
Okay, so how does that fit the definition of residential real property?
Well, I think you have to dig deeper, because otherwise you could just arbitrarily include the title, this is a commercial transaction, when you know darn well that there's an actual residence on the property.
Well, there's no question this was... You're not disputing this was a commercial property, are you?
No, I'm not. It was titled as such, but there was a residence and a dwelling unit on the property, and as the Miller case has indicated, if there's a dwelling unit, you've got to have a proper disclosure statement. And, Your Honor, the purpose of these disclosure statements is...
I'm sorry, I'm going to do one more follow-up.
Yeah.
So the other thing about the definition is a residential real property consisting of not more than 4 family dwelling units. So if you had, you know, a structure that has 6, well, that's still a dwelling unit, that has six units in it. The way it's written is a limitation. So in other words, we're not going to include an apartment building or a townhouse that has six units in this, because then you're that wouldn't fit it.
That's
either.
Correct.
And that's clearly a property where people are residing. So when I think about it in that context, it does appear that that term residential has some real significance there. And what is your thought on that?
Well, I think the statute is clearly written that if it's more than four, it doesn't count. Property disclosure statute is not triggered. If it's less than four, as the legislature has drafted it, it triggers it. Now, there is a good question for the court to determine, or the legislature, that in a mixed transaction, what do we do? Do we require the disclosure statement for the entirety of the property? My argument would be yes. Do we require it for just the residential portion, which undoubtedly we have here in this case, potentially? The fact of the matter is, it wasn't done here. And Mr. Hurd's argument that in a limited agency scenario, no fiduciary duties required and no disclosure statement advice from the professionals required goes down a very bad path. And I don't think that's the intent of the legislature, and I don't think that's the intent of this court through its prior rulings. Specifically, in the Rosum case, that was a dual agency limited agent scenario. This court affirmed the jury instruction to the jury regarding fiduciary duty. I believe Mr. Iverson had a fiduciary duty to both of his clients, had a duty to advise them that a property disclosure statement was required. And it's important to consider the reason for these disclosure statements, and they're universal throughout the country. It protects buyers. It encourages honest communications, which promotes market integrity, reduces legal disputes, and conserves judicial resources. Facilitates efficient market operations. Transactions are simply less likely to fall through.
What's the source of the fiduciary duty then that you've just identified? He says it isn't statutory.
I believe it's through the case law. The Says case is clear on it. The Jack Quo v. Rosum case is clear on it. These are professionals. These professionals have a duty. In fact, one of the greatest lines from the Says case: why have realty agents for buyers if agents supposedly knowledgeable in real estate transactions have no obligation to tell clients that sellers are required by law to give a disclosure statement? Your Honor, my time is up, but I will field any further questions if you have them. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.